Reza Aslan is an Iranian-American scholar of religious studies, writer, and television host. He has written three books on religion, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, Beyond Fundamentalism, Confronting Religious Extremism in the Age of Globalism, and Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, No God But God. Here's one, God, A Human History, and Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, which was had a profound impact on me. Aslan is a member of the American Academy of Religion, the Society of Biblical Literature, and the International Quranic Studies Association. He's also a professor of creative writing at University of California, Riverside. He is currently a board member of the National Iranian American Council. Once his presentation has concluded, we will have an open mic Q&A for about 20 minutes, and then we can move into the foyer where he can sign some books for you. Professor Aslan, thank you.
I'm going to go down there. All right. Hi, everybody. Hi. What a joy and a blessing it is to be here. Thanks so much. I've been trying to get down here for a few years now. I hope that wasn't important. It's been, I think, like 3 years or so that Lindsay has asked me to come in and be a part of this conference. And if you know Lindsay, you know that you can't say no to her. And so we've been trying, and the schedule has never worked, and it just happened to work because I'm actually on the fourth annual Aslan RV vacation. I just happened to be passing through town in an RV with my family. This is my only clean shirt. I washed my hair today for the first time in 6 days. So this is a special treat for me. I hope it is for you as well. I'm very excited about an opportunity to talk to you guys. I was told to come and, basically cause some trouble and get this symposium underway, and I'm good at causing trouble. So I guess I'm saying I'm very proud to be the non-Mormon that starts this whole thing. So, thank you. Thank you for having me. Let's talk about God, shall we? I mean, what could go wrong? Nothing could go wrong. There are, in the long and intimately linked history of religions, many, many myths of creation. There are those myths in which a god acts on some kind of primal matter, and in doing so, creates form and order out of chaos. Take, for instance, the great Egyptian god Atum, the world finisher, as he's known. In Egyptian mythology, Atum spent an eternity drifting along the primordial waters of creation until he finally settled upon a sacred mound known as the Benben. And there, on that mound, since he was the only being in existence, he masturbated into the waters of creation, and in doing so, all the great gods of Egypt arose. Shu and Tefnut and Geb and Nut, and their obviously far more famous children, Isis and Osiris, Set and Nephthys. In some creation myths, the creator is an artist or a craftsman of some sort who literally fashions creation with his hands. For instance, Napi, the creator god of the Blackfoot Indians. Napi was an old man who traversed the length and width of the earth, carving out the valleys and rivers with his tools, planting the fields and the meadows and the forests, literally scooping up the mountains with his bare hands. Sometimes creation comes quite by accident, and often through some sort of divine sexual union. So, for instance, in the Mesopotamian myths of creation, you have an event in which Apsu, who is the god of fresh waters, and Tiamat, the goddess of the oceans, merge together in body and soul. And in doing so, they birthed the first generation of Mesopotamian gods, Lahmu, whose name means mud, and his sister Lahamu, whose name means silt. And then those two birth Anshar, whose name means sky, and his sister Kishu. Those two, Kishu means earth, by the way. Those two come together, and they birth Anu, which means the horizon. And Anu becomes sort of the liminal space between his parents. Often, in fact, quite often, the creative act first requires some kind of act of destruction, right? A sacrifice or a murder from which the universe unexpectedly emerges. This is a very common creation myth in the history of religions. Perhaps the most famous version of this is the story of Fan Ku, who is the creator god of China. Fan Ku, as the myth goes, was born in an egg-shaped universe. Inside the egg was no thing, but inside no thing was Fan Ku, who bursts from the egg as a giant covered in hair. With his chisel, he separates the earth from the sky. The earth becomes yin, the sky becomes yang, opposites and yet interdependent. And then, when Fan Ku finally dies, his skull becomes the dome of the sky, his blood becomes the rivers and seas, his bones become the mountains and the rocks, his breath becomes the wind, and his death rattle becomes the thunder. And then there are those perhaps more familiar creation myths, myths in which the creative act is intentional. When a lonesome god sitting on some kind of cosmic throne suddenly gives voice to a thought, let there be, and then just as suddenly there is. But regardless of how creation is envisioned, what most of these myths have in common is the belief that human beings were created by the gods and in their image, whether to serve them or to love them, as slaves or as equals, accidentally or on purpose, with delight or with regret. As the Hebrew scriptures say, God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. That's Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. I've been studying the religions of the world for most of my adult life, and I can tell you with some measure of certainty that whether you believe in one God or many gods or no God at all, it is we who have given our image to God, not the other way around. Now, I want to be clear here. I don't mean to say that there's no such thing as God or that what we call God is wholly a human invention. I personally believe in God, but I have absolutely no interest whatsoever in trying to prove the existence or the non-existence of God to anyone else, for the simple reason that there is no such proof either way. Faith is a choice. Anyone who tells you otherwise is trying to convert you. Faith is an experiential phenomenon, not a rational one. It is fundamentally an emotion, like love. You either love someone or you don't. And whether you do or not has little to do with reason or rationality or the acceptance of some well-argued point. No one can convince you to love someone or not. And the same is true of faith. You either believe there is something beyond the material realm, something real, something knowable, or you don't. If, like me, you do, then you must ask yourself another question. Do you care? Does it matter to you? Do you wish to experience this thing, whatever it is, however it's defined? Do you wish to know it? Do you wish to commune with it? If so, then it helps to have some kind of language with which to express what is fundamentally an inexpressible idea. And that's where religion comes in. And here, I think it might be important to just take a moment and differentiate between faith and religion, because these are not the same thing. They are often treated as though they are the same, but they are not the same thing. Faith, which is primarily what I want to talk about tonight, is individualistic. It's mysterious. It's ineffable. It's in some ways undefinable. Faith, as we shall talk about in a moment, is embedded in the brain. It is fundamentally a part of the human condition. It is what it means to be human. For what it means to be human is ultimately to strive for transcendence, that which is beyond. Religion, on the other hand, is nothing more or less than the language that we use to express our faith. Beyond the myths and the rituals, the temples, the cathedrals, the do's and the don'ts that have, for millennia, separated humanity into competing and often violent camps of belief, religion is simply an institutionalized language made up of symbols and metaphors that provides a means for people of faith, those who've chosen faith, to express to themselves and to each other that which is fundamentally inexpressible, the experience of transcendence. Now, there are many symbols to choose from, many metaphors to choose from. Some of these have been forged through thousands of years of conflict and contemplation. Others are quite recent. New religions arise all the time, and with them, new ways of thinking about God, new metaphors, new symbols. The point that I'm trying to make, and what I really want to talk about tonight, the point that is illustrated in many ways by the creation myths that I outlined earlier, is just this: that throughout the history of religions, there has been one symbol that has stood out as universal and supreme, one grand metaphor for God from which practically every other symbol and metaphor in nearly all the world's religions has been derived. And that metaphor is us, the human being. Indeed, the entire history of human spirituality can be viewed as one long, interconnected, ever-evolving, and remarkably cohesive attempt by human beings to make sense of God by giving God a name and a personality, by ascribing human attributes to God, by providing God with human desires, human strengths, human weaknesses, human virtues, and human vices, even a human body. In short, by transforming God into a human being. And this, I think, is something that will very likely launch some very interesting conversations in our Q&A. In fact, numerous studies by cognitive scientists have shown that whether we are conscious of it or not, regardless of whether we are believers or not, what the vast majority of us think about when we think about God is not just a human being, but with superhuman powers, but more specifically, one human being in particular, ourselves. I mean this quite literally. Our image of God, what we think God literally looks like, has been repeatedly proven in study after study to be little more than an idealized image of ourselves. Just this year, researchers at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, showed 511 American Christians pairs of photos and asked them a very simple question: which face looks more like God? What they discovered was that subjects automatically began constructing God's face to look more or less like their own faces. Older people made God's face older. Younger people made God younger. Black and Latino participants made God's complexion darker. White participants made a God who looked like someone that could only be described as a surfer from California named Sean. They actually have that image, and that's exactly what it looks like, a guy named Sean. Actually, it gets even weirder than that. Self-described conservatives constructed God's face to look more masculine, while liberals constructed God's face to look more feminine. In other words, if you watch MSNBC, your God will have delicate features, right? Whereas if you watch Fox News, you need to have your brain examined. The study's conclusion was one that scholars of religion have known for a very, very long time. Human beings not only imagine God in human terms, we imagine God to look and think and feel and act exactly like we do. It seems that the ancient Greek philosopher Xenophanes may have been on to something when he wrote, quote, "If cattle or horses or lions had hands and could draw and could sculpt like men, then horses would draw their gods like horses and cattle like cattle." Here's the fascinating part about this. Because you see, it turns out that we are evolutionarily adapted to think of God in human terms. We have no choice in the matter. It's literally a function of the brain. In fact, if you go back to the very origins of the religious experience, you can see how the very process through which the concept of God arose in human evolution compels us to conceive of God in human terms. Indeed, this concept that I'm just going to call the humanized God, this concept was embedded in our consciousness the moment the idea of God first arose in our evolution. It led to our earliest theorizing about the nature of the universe and our place in it. It informed our first physical representations of the non-material world, the world beyond ours. Belief in humanized gods guided us as hunter-gatherers, and then, tens of thousands of years later, compelled us to swap our spears for plows and begin planting instead. Our first temples were built by people who thought of the gods as superhuman beings, as were our first religions. The Mesopotamians, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Indians, the Persians, the Hebrews, the Arabs, all devised their theistic systems in human terms and with human imagery. The same holds true, actually, for non-theistic religions like Jainism or Theravada Buddhism, both of which conceive of the spirits and the devas that populate their theologies as little more than superhuman beings. In fact, in the larger, more mainstream Mahayana branch of Buddhism, the Buddha's appearance on earth is traditionally viewed as the manifestation of pure Dharma, but in human terms and in a human form. Even those believers who strive so hard to profess what we can call theologically correct beliefs about a soul, singular God who is incorporeal or infallible, ever-present or all-knowing, even they cannot help but to envision God in human form and to speak of God in human terms. Studies performed by a range of psychologists and cognitive scientists have shown that the most devout believers when forced to communicate their thoughts about God, overwhelmingly treat God as though they were talking about some person they had met on the street. Why do we do this? Why do we do this? What is behind this involuntary impulse that all peoples have to humanize God, whether they believe in God or not? In fact, one of the most fascinating parts of this is that atheists do the exact same thing. That when you ask a person who says they don't believe in God what they actually mean when they say God, they do what all of us do. They start to describe themselves, but in divine terms. Well, to answer this question, I think we need to go back, and I mean back, like all the way back, to the very origins of the religious experience. That is, to the moment in which the very concept of God first arose in human evolution. Now, what is undeniable is that the propensity for religious belief is inherent in our species. On this point, there is no disagreement between scholars and scientists. The religious impulse, or what I've been calling here the faith experience, however you want to refer to it, is so widespread that it must be considered an elemental part of the human experience. It reaches deep, deep into our evolutionary past. Indeed, we have ample material evidence, whether we're talking about grave sites or temples or idols, showing unambiguous signs of religious belief that date back hundreds of thousands of years before our species, Homo sapiens, even existed. So then there is no other way to look at religious belief except as a product of human evolution. But if that's true, if religious belief is a product of human evolution, if it indeed predates the existence of Homo sapiens, and it does, then there must be some adaptive advantage to it. Otherwise, according to the Darwinian rules of evolution, there would be no reason for religion to exist. Now, for more than 200 years or so, scholars of religion and evolutionary biologists alike have been racking their brains trying to figure out what exactly the adaptive advantage of religious belief actually is. Why, in other words, do we believe? Why is religious belief universal? Why is the faith experience universal and inherent to the human species? Some have argued that religion arose in human evolution to answer unanswerable questions. You've heard this, I'm sure. Or to help early humans manage what was a threatening and unpredictable world. It's an explanation for religious experience that remains fairly popular to this day. Well, there's no doubt that for a great many people, religion does help make sense of a mystifying and volatile experience. The question is what, if any, adaptive advantage that would have among primitive peoples who are desperately trying to simply survive the day-to-day experience of prehistoric life. In other words, how exactly does offering soothing yet ever-shifting answers to the mysteries of the universe support the survival of the species? There's literally no reason to think that it would. Regardless, for this theory to actually hold true, one would have to prove that there are certain emotions that are peculiar to religious expression, or that all religious expressions trigger similar emotions, and neither of those things are true. One can experience the same sense of awe, the same sense of comfort, the same sense of fearlessness that so many people feel in response to religion in almost any non-religious circumstance. Actually, despite common perception, there is simply no evidence whatsoever for the existence of any emotion that is utterly unique to religion, not even transcendence, and thus no reason to conclude that religious feelings are uniquely beneficial to human survival. Okay, so that doesn't work. Others have said, okay, well, maybe religion arose as a kind of social adhesive, right? A means of fostering cohesion and maintaining solidarity or communal identity among primitive peoples. This is probably to this day the most widely held explanation for the origins of the religious impulse. And evolutionarily speaking, it makes a certain amount of sense to assume that by banding together around a common set of symbols and participating in a shared ritual experience, our ancient ancestors were able to enhance their collective identity. And then, of course, as a result, they were able to increase their chances of survival in what would have been a savagely competitive world. But the trouble with this line of reasoning is that there is nothing intrinsically unifying or cohesive about religion. I mean, this crowd knows that better than most crowds, right? Religion, yes, it certainly has the power to bring disparate people together, but it is just as efficient a dividing force as it is a uniting one. Religion engenders both inclusion and exclusion. It spawns as much conflict in a society as it does cohesion. It benefits some members of a community more than, and often at the expense of, others. It delegitimizes as much as it legitimizes. More to the point, the theory of social cohesion is dependent upon the idea that religion was the primary, most dominant source of attachment among prehistoric peoples, and that is emphatically not the case. Kinship is a stronger and far more primal tool for social cohesion in our human evolution. Look, our Paleolithic ancestors lived in small-scale communities, basically an extended family sharing a single shelter. Their sense of solidarity was engendered first and foremost by birth and blood, not by symbols and rituals. To argue that religion arose in human evolution because it gave believing communities an adaptive advantage over non-believing communities would require the existence in religion of some uniquely cohesive property that it simply does not possess. There can be no doubt that religion's communal properties allowed religion to survive throughout human history. But whether those same communal properties allowed religiously inclined humans to survive better than non-religiously inclined humans is questionable at best. Okay, so those two don't work. Maybe it's because the primary purpose of religion is to alleviate discontent. Right? This is the great Freudian explanation for why religion exists, right? Religion's primary purpose, according to Freud, is that it lessens suffering, it lessens anxiety, it allays fears of the unknown. If you weren't aware of the fact that Sigmund Freud knows absolutely nothing about religion, now you know that for sure, okay? Because anyone who believes that religion's primary function is to alleviate guilt or anxiety doesn't know what they're talking about. Under no circumstances could religion be considered intrinsically a source of comfort. Quite the contrary. Religion perpetrates as much anxiety and guilt in people's lives as it alleviates. As the legendary American anthropologist Clifford Geertz famously wrote, quote, "Religion has probably disturbed men as much as it has cheered them." Religion often involves wrathful, capricious spirits whose pleasure requires backbreaking physical and psychological effort from worshipers. Evolutionarily speaking, it requires actions that carry enormous costs in terms of energy and resources, both of which would be far better spent on, you know, survival. There is a variation of this theory, of course. That variation is that, and you've heard this, that religion's primary purpose is in human evolution was to motivate altruistic behavior, right? To control primitive populations, to keep us basically from tearing each other apart, right? We would have all killed ourselves. We would have killed each other if it weren't for religion, and that's why it exists. That's why it's part of our evolution. Again, okay, it's certainly true that religion can enhance altruistic behavior between individuals, though, you know, it's equally adept at promoting selfishness, as most of us know. But once again, the question remains whether religion has some kind of unique moral effect on society. Cognitive scientist Paul Bloom, who's conducted years of research examining exactly how religion and religious belief affect moral views, has concluded that there is little evidence that, quote, the world's religions have an important effect on our moral lives. In fact, study after study has demonstrated that the good and bad moral effects of religion are no more or less powerful than the good and bad moral effects of any other social practice. But okay, even if for the sake of argument, we're going to concede that religion can mitigate the social effects of social behavior in a group, even if we give you that, it still does not adequately explain how or why religion evolved in the first place. What we call religious morality played absolutely no role in the spiritual lives of primitive peoples. Belief in a divine lawgiver who determines good and bad behavior is barely 5,000 years old. Belief in a heavenly reward for such behavior is even newer. Look, we've been asking why religious belief exists for a very, very long time, and the truthful answer is that we just don't know. We simply do not know. What is clear, however, what is fast becoming the consensus among scholars and scientists alike, is that there is no adaptive advantage to the religious impulse, and therefore no direct evolutionary reason for it to exist. To quote the anthropologist Scott Atran, religion is, quote, materially expensive and unrelentingly counterfactual, even counterintuitive. Religious practice is costly in terms of material sacrifice, at least one's prayer time, emotional expenditure, inciting fears, hopes, as we talked about, and cognitive effort. And so, as Paul Bloom, the aforementioned Paul Bloom, concludes, quote, religious belief is an unlikely candidate for biological adaptation. Okay, then, if that's true, then what explains it? What explains the religious impulse? Why did belief in God arise in human evolution in the first place? Well, some of the cognitive scientists and evolutionary biologists that I've just mentioned, they have an answer. They believe that faced with this evolutionary puzzle, which is the universality of supernatural beliefs, that they've come up with an innovative solution. Religion, they say, is not an evolutionary adaptation. Religion is the accidental byproduct of some other pre-existing evolutionary adaptation. I go deep into this argument in the book. What exactly were those evolutionary adaptations that arose deep in our evolutionary past that, according to these neuroscientists and evolutionary biologists, created totally by accident and totally as a byproduct, a kind of echo, this universal belief in God, this sort of the universal faith experience. For those of you who are either too lazy or cheap to buy the book, essentially it's a combination of two, and I'm not going to get too deeply in, maybe we'll get a little bit deeper into it in the Q&A, but it's essentially a combination of two evolutionary processes, one of which is called the hyperactive agency detection device, or HADD, H-A-D-D. That's that thing that makes you think that every bump in the night is caused by someone doing the bumping. So in other words, it is a evolutionary process embedded in our brains. It's part of our early cognitive processes that compels us to apply agency to any natural phenomenon that we engage, right? There's got to be something behind what just happened. That obviously has evolutionary advantage to it, right? Obviously, if you're like, you know, a Paleolithic man and you're, you know, going through the woods in the middle of the night and you hear a rustling, just assume it's a bear. Assume it's a bear and freeze or run. It's better to assume incorrectly and survive. That is an evolutionary adaptive advantage. According to the theory, if you combine that with an even earlier cognitive process, something that's called the theory of mind, a little bit more complicated, but essentially what theory of mind is, it's that thing that turns on in your brain, I believe, sometime around 6 months old, 6 months old or so, 6 to 8 months old. It's a thing that turns on in your brain that makes you recognize that somebody who looks like you also feels like you, right? It's an empathy device, right? It's what keeps you from just walking around poking people in the eye for no reason, because you have an eye and you can imagine how that would feel. That's called theory of mind. So the current most popular consensus view of why religion exists is that somehow HADD and theory of mind, when combined together, sent this echo into our cognitive processes totally by accident, and that echo became the universality of religious belief. Pretty good answer, I guess. Unprovable, but okay, maybe. That's a good answer. Here's another good answer. Maybe we're just made this way. Maybe we are meant to be believing creatures. Perhaps the reason for the universality of religious belief is that we are homo religiosus. Not in our desire for creeds or institutions, no. Not in our commitment to specific gods or specific theologies. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about in our existential striving for transcendence, toward that which lies beyond the manifest world. After all, numerous cognitive studies have shown that children are born with an instinctual propensity for what is often referred to as substance dualism, the idea that the body and mind / soul, however you want to think about that, are separate and distinct. We are born with that belief. It is a belief that has to be unlearned. Belief in the soul is an inherent belief. So, perhaps the origin of religious belief, the faith experience, is not rooted in our quest for meaning or our fear of the unknown. Perhaps it's not born of our involuntary reactions to the natural world, as some believe. Maybe it's not the consequence of our desire for a communal identity. Maybe it's just simply a facet of the complex workings of our brain. Maybe it's the result of something far more primal and far more difficult to explain. Our ingrained, intuitive, and wholly experiential belief that we are, whatever else we are, eternal souls inside material bodies. As I said at the beginning, there's no proof either way. It's just a choice. So choose one of these. However, whether you believe that religious belief is the accidental evolutionary byproduct or some other adaptive advantage, or whether you believe it's simply part of the way that we were purposely designed, this one fact should not be ignored. Religion is first and foremost a neurological phenomenon. In other words, whatever else the religious impulse may represent, whatever its purpose may be, whatever reason it arose in human evolution, it is fundamentally a function of complex electrochemical reactions in the brain. Now, the response to religion is the result of complex electrochemical reactions to the brain should be, So what? Everything is the result of complex electrochemical reactions in the brain. Like literally everything, every experience you have ever had, every emotion you have ever had, this conversation right now, you sitting there, me talking to you, all of it is just electrochemical reactions in your brain. So what? That the faith experience is too. Right? Just this fact alone is not a compelling observation. It doesn't diminish or delegitimize the faith experience. Of course not. Why would it? Knowing the neural mechanics of the religious impulse does not undermine the legitimacy of religious belief any more than knowing the exact chemical process of love makes the feeling any less real, or the object of our affection any less worthy. What it does mean, however, is that if we truly want to talk about the origins of the religious impulse, we should not be looking to material evidence, things that we dig up, you know, in the ground, temples that we uncover, idols that we find. No, instead, we should be looking to the source of that experience, and the source of that experience is right here. It's the brain. And this is where we return to that involuntary impulse I was talking about at the beginning of this talk. Our innate, unconscious desire to conceive of God in our own image. It kind of makes sense now, right? After all, if belief is a function of the brain, and it is, then the very cognitive process through which the awareness of God arose in evolution, whether by accident or according to some grand design, compels us to think about God in human terms. It compels us to use ourselves as the primary model for conceiving of God. And now you know what I meant when I said that we can't help it, that we're just made this way. It's a function of our brains. Thinking about God in human terms is just how our brains work. But that's no excuse. Because regardless of whether we can help it or not, there are some very grave consequences to our natural impulse to humanize the divine. Think about it. When we conceive of a God who looks and thinks and feels and acts like us, all we are doing is projecting upon God our own best and worst attributes. We bestow upon God not just all that is good in human nature, our capacity for boundless love, our empathy, our eagerness to show compassion, our thirst for justice, but all that is bad in it, our aggression and greed, our bias and our bigotries, our penchant for extreme acts of violence. We make God a mirror reflecting back to us our own virtues and vices, our own strengths and shortcomings. Our desires become God's desires, but without boundaries. Our actions become God's actions, but without consequence. We create a superhuman being endowed with human attributes, but without human limitations. And then we fashion our religions and our cultures, our societies and our governments according to our own human urges, all the while convincing ourselves that those urges are actually God's. That, more than anything else, explains why throughout human history, religion has been a force both for boundless good and for unspeakable evil. Why the same faith in the same God inspires love and compassion in one believer and hatred and violence in the other. Why two people can approach the exact same scripture at the exact same time and walk away with two radically opposing interpretations of it. Indeed, most of the religious conflicts that continue to roil our world are built upon our innate, unconscious desire to make ourselves the apotheosis of what God is and what God wants, who God loves and who God hates. But it doesn't have to be like this. It may be true that we are evolutionarily adapted to conceptualize God in human terms, but it's equally true that casting off this humanizing impulse, though it takes enormous cognitive effort, is something that we should do. We should cast it off for all the reasons that I mentioned earlier. Let me get personal here for just 1 minute. I began this talk by saying that I believe in God. But the God I believe in is not a personalized God. It is a dehumanized God, a God with no material form, a God who doesn't look like me, or think like me, or act like me, a God who doesn't love what I love, who doesn't hate what I hate, a God who doesn't share my prejudices or my politics, a God who doesn't share my race or my ethnicity or my nationality. Most importantly, a God who doesn't share my religion. I believe in a God who is pure existence without name, preference, or personality. A God who is, if God is anything else, quintessentially not human. Now, I came to this God through my own long and admittedly circuitous spiritual journey, both as a scholar of religions and as a person of faith. It was a journey that took me from a spiritually inclined child who thought of God as an old man with magical powers to a devout Christian who imagined God as a perfect human being, to a Muslim who rejected Christianity in favor of a God who is singular, eternal, and indivisible, and then finally to a Sufi who thought of God simply as divine unity. A God who by definition is singular, eternal, and indivisible. A God who cannot be separated from his creation. I worship this God not through fear and trembling, but through awe and wonder at the workings of the universe, for the universe is God. I pray to this God not to ask for things, but to become one with God. I root my moral choices neither in fear of eternal punishment nor in hope of eternal reward. I recognize the divinity of the world and every being in it, and respond to everyone and everything as though everyone and everything were God, because everyone and everything is God. My hope, besides ruffling some feathers, is that all of us, believers and unbelievers alike, can learn to cast off this universal impulse to humanize the divine, to recognize that God did not create us in his image, nor did we create God in ours, but rather, let us just consider the idea that we are the image of God in the world, not in form, not in likeness, but in essence, in substance. If that's true, then it means that the only way we can truly know God is to rely on the only thing that we can truly know, ourselves. To quote the great Islamic sage Ibn al-Arabi, "He who knows his soul knows his Lord." Thank you.
Thank you. That gives me a lot to think about. We want to open this up for questions for the till about 8:40. So if you have questions, please raise your hand. We can run the mic out to you, and we will we'll run them back and forth.
Sounds great.
Awesome. We'll just start right here.
Is there any way to get a copy of your talk? Are you going to publish it somewhere, or?
Did you guys record it? I don't know. It's possibly.
Yes, recording.
I mean, I will say that a large part of what I talked about is the subject of my most recent book, God, A Human History. So that might help.
Awesome. Thank you.
Going back to something you said very early in your talk, you made a very strong delineation between the experiential and the rational.
Yeah.
And there's kind of irony a little bit that your talk was almost entirely rational. I want to just raise this up against what Christian tradition often calls the dark night of the soul. And I inferred from the last part of your talk, where you talked about your own journey, that perhaps you had faced that maybe on more than one occasion. But your path, and often the path of the dark night of the soul, is when the answers that you have no longer fit the evidence. So it leads to a more and more rational theology. Rationalized theology. And I wonder if you could just comment on that. And then also the risk you run in telling your own sort of what this group might call your own testimony,
right,
is in saying, you should all be like me.
Yeah. Well, to your latter point, I think that's kind of, you know, what I wanted to do was not be instructive or prescriptive, but to just simply say, this is what I believe. This is how I believe. And I would like people to consider that as a possibility. I understand that the notion of a pantheistic God, because that's fundamentally what I'm referring to here, right? The idea, pantheism, for those of you unfamiliar with the term, it's a very new term for an ancient idea, and in fact, what I would argue is the first real the first thing that we can call religious expression is pantheism. Pantheism simply means God is all is God. It's a belief that exists in almost every religious tradition, particularly those religious traditions who tend to think of a singular God. It requires this whole sort of rejection of a dichotomy between, or a separation, I should say, between creator and creation. And we can talk more about that in a moment. But I get that it's a profoundly unpopular belief because it comes across, again, as extremely unsatisfying, right? Part of the reason why this humanizing impulse is so strong is that it's comforting. It's nice. It's easy. I was just having this conversation actually just a little while ago about part of the reason why I think Christianity is such a successful religion, and why the most successful religion in the history of the world, and why it will very likely continue to be so for quite some time, is that it answers the most fundamental question of human existence, the question that all religions seek to answer: what is God? It answers in the simplest way possible. What is God? God's a man. Think of the most perfect man. Perfectly kind, perfectly compassionate, perfectly loving. Everyone have that image in their mind? That's God. Thanks, everyone. I mean, it's enormously appealing. Forget about the fact that it does sort of scratch that cognitive itch that we all have anyway, right? Christianity says, oh, you're sort of evolutionarily adapted to think about God in human terms. That's interesting, because God's actually literally a human being. Literally a human being. So that's fine. It's hugely appealing. It's what drew me to it. Whereas pantheism says, no, God is just a personalityless, creative force underlying the entirety of the universe. That's not appealing. That's not very appealing. Though I do think that it allows for a far deeper spirituality. So I'm not trying to convert you. I'm just saying, think about it. To your first point, which I think is very, very good, thank you so much for bringing that up. Because this issue of reason and rationality and the role that these things play in religion is one that we've been debating for a very, very long time. And as you well know, there are many, many people, believers and unbelievers alike, who feel as though there is no role for reason or rationality in religion, or as you put it, in theology. But I'm not talking about religion. And I'm not talking about theology, right? I'm talking about something that is absolutely different than religion. I'm talking about faith. The whole point of this is that those two things are not the same. Faith is embedded in our cognitive processes. That's why I went through that whole long-winded thing. It exists here. We are born with it. And that, I think, the best way to think about, instead of trying to come up with sort of reason and rational explanations of why you believe in God and you do not, and whether you can convince this person or that person can convince you, is instead to think about faith in differently, to think about it as an experiential phenomenon, to think about it as an emotion. Once you start thinking about faith as an emotion, and yes, it's a metaphor, but still, once you start thinking about faith as an emotion, then these stupid conversations that we sometimes find ourselves embroiled in when we're starting to like argue about theology suddenly stop making any sense. It would be akin to having some argument about whether you actually love your wife or not. No one can know that but you. The love that you have, like any emotion, is based on who you are as an individual, the experiences that you have had, how you were raised, where you were raised, by whom you were raised. It is purely experiential. And I think that's what I mean when I talk about faith being an experiential, not a rational phenomenon. Of course, as a scholar of religions, I mean, I'm actually contractually obligated to say that, of course, reason and religion, you know, go hand in hand. But I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about something much more mysterious and personal.
Thanks. You were talking earlier about those cognitive scientists and sort of the claim that, I think you clarified, that religion kind of, that faith lives in the brain. Do you or do the cognitive scientists make a distinction between faith living in the brain and faith, and the brain being the source of faith? Because I see them as being a little different. So you can talk about that.
That's a very, very interesting distinction. I think that probably people like Paul Bloom and Scott Atran, people like Jesse Baring, Justin Barrett, you know, some of the people who are at the forefront of what is now being referred to increasingly as the neurological study of religion, would say that faith, that the brain is the source of faith. For the most part, I think that's what they would say. I think that others, you know, who would accept the science purely without question, accept the evidence, would say that faith lives in the brain, that it's part of the functioning of the brain. I most definitely fall into that latter category. I don't deny the science by any means. But I also recognize that, as I was joking about earlier, that it's not an interesting observation to say that faith exists in the brain. Like that's, I always find myself occasionally stuck in these conversations with the so-called new atheists who are preaching not atheism, but what I like to call scientism, because they've turned science into a kind of religion, which is weird and should make all scientists just absolutely aghast. But nevertheless, I get into these arguments where they say, well, look, I don't have to take any of this seriously anymore because I know where in the brain faith exists. I could put on one of these helmets, I could push a couple of buttons, and I can have you have a religious experience. Therefore, there is no such thing as a religious experience. What? Call yourself a scientist? What kind of argument is that? I could do the exact same thing and make you feel love. I could do the exact same thing and make you feel fear. I could make you feel anxiety. It doesn't delegitimize those emotions. Of course it exists in the brain. That's not interesting. That's just obvious. So my problem is using that fundamental fact as a way to devalue the religious experience. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Thank you very much for a most interesting presentation. You kept pointing to here, and it's one of the questions. The new field of neurocardiology suggests that this metaphor is more than metaphor when Jesus says, as a person thinks in his heart or in her heart, so is she or is she, is he, and that this new science that has identified this complete communication that the heart sends more information to the brain than the brain sends to the heart, and then what is this thing called consciousness, and where does it reside? It reminds me in the Midrash of the young rabbi who gets up and runs out every morning, and the older rabbi says, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking to see if the Messiah has come. And the rabbi says, in here he's already come.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in the idea of consciousness, which we don't know where it exists. Is it the locus here? Is it here? Is it somewhere else? And I'd just be curious.
No, listen, you're a closet Sufi. In fact, with Sufism talks about the qalb as the source of our inner selves, right? When I use the word soul, you understand that it's an anachronistic way of talking about fundamentally what we would refer to as kind of the inner you. You can talk about it as consciousness. I think that's a perfectly fine way, a synonym for soul. I think that the mind actually is a pretty good synonym for the soul. And I sort of go back and forth between all of these words, but soul is the one that we all get, right? We all know what we mean when we use that term, even though it is, frankly, in the history of religions, a fairly new term. But you're absolutely right that this kind of idea that instead of this mind-body dichotomy, right, the substance dualism, that what mystics in all religions strive for is a merging of those two things, not a distinction between them, right? Correct, right? That there isn't a distinction. Hence, notions of bodily resurrection and all of those things that exist in a number of religious traditions. That's a very, very good point, and thank you for bringing that up. Maybe a lady?
I'm a lady.
Oh, hi.
And I even have a lady question.
All right, lady question.
Because here's my question. When I was growing up, I had a church teacher that told me, like, when you're praying, imagine God right in front of you. Picture what he looks like. And for years, I would pray, and I would imagine a white man, probably about 40, like a nice dad, mm-hmm. with a beard, white hair.
Yep.
And when you were talking about people picking out pictures that looked like them for God, I thought, you know what? I mean, I'm white, but I don't have a beard. I was like a 13-year-old girl. And I was like, I kind of get it. Like, he was my culture. He was my race. But as a woman, and even Mormonism, I don't know how much you know about Mormonism. We even teach that there is a Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother, right? But we don't pray to her. So I never imagined her. So when I think of God, I think of an older white man. And I thought, is that everyone, everywhere, we all think of a man? And why do we think of a man for God? Wouldn't I be thinking of someone like me? Wouldn't I think of a mom, a woman? And why do we do that? And maybe do some people in some cultures do that, think of a woman for God? Those are my questions.
I love this question. Thank you. So of the 511 participants in the UNC Chapel Hill study that I was talking about, 225 of them were women. Of the 225, not a single one created God as a woman. Not one of them. Now, you stop and you think, well, but that doesn't make any sense, until you realize all 511 were American Protestants. All 511. Whether they were black or Latino, male or female, they came from one particular tradition. And it is a tradition that I don't need to tell you, is paternalistic and patriarchal, and which overtly uses male imagery to talk about a being that could not possibly have gender by any means. You know, if your God has a gender, then what the hell kind of God are you talking about? And yet, it is such a culturally powerful idea, particularly in the Protestant and the American Christian tradition, that we are all infected by it, that you don't have a choice but to think this way. But it is not a universal phenomenon. On the contrary. In fact, when people are asked the same question, in whether it's in pre-literate societies or whether it's in developed societies that happen to have a different majority religion, you do see women tend to describe a motherly kind of deity, and men very clearly create a masculine kind of deity. But yes, it's an indication of something that I never, ever get tired of saying, which is that there is just literally no such thing as religion divorced from culture. It doesn't exist. The idea of religion in a vacuum is a figment of the imagination. There is no such thing as the pure, Lindsay said this perfectly, there's no such thing as the pure form of religion and then its adulterated ways in which it attaches to culture. No, religion and culture are a unified, singular thing. They can't be divorced from each other. what you call, what a white Midwestern Christian calls Christianity, has very little to do with what a brown Guatemalan farm worker calls Christianity. How that white Midwestern Christian imagines Jesus bears almost no semblance whatsoever to how that coffee picker in the hills of Guatemala imagines Jesus. You can't divorce religion from culture.
Let me go back over here.
Another lady question.
We'll rotate on the women for a minute.
Thank you. Thank you. It was so, I was hanging on every word. Oh, it was so lovely. You've been on a journey, obviously, with your upbringing and then all of the scholarship that you have created and learned. And I'd love to know, what things do you personally find have been beneficial for you in your spirituality? Just personally, what you do daily and what you found is really speaks to you.
Thank you for that. That's a question I rarely get. Thank you. It's different now that I'm older. You know, I feel like when I was younger, my connection to the divine was clearer. Maybe it's because I had fewer distractions. Maybe that's what it was. I think for me now, that connection is... it's less special, it's more mundane in a weird way, you know? I still pray, but not the way that I used to. Prayer, for me, has become a kind of constant communication, you know, with creation. It's not a means, as I was saying before, of asking for things. If you think of creation as the creator's conversation, the creator's monologue, to me, prayer turns that monologue into a dialogue, if that makes sense. As a Sufi, I take part in what are called zikrs. Zikrs are the sort of the primary ritual that Sufis engage in. We sort of get together and form a giant circle, and then we just... Zikr literally means remembrance. We remember God. We just sort of chant God's name and breathe and move and sort of try to break through the veil of this reality and try to achieve some measure of unity with the divine. But I guess what I would say is this... you know, when you study the religions of the world for a living, it becomes difficult to take any one of those religions all that seriously anymore. It certainly becomes difficult to take any of those religions' truth claims all that seriously anymore, because what you recognize very, very quickly is that these are all different languages for the same sentiment. Right, that they're different metaphors, but they're different symbols, but that underneath it, it's the same feeling, it's the same emotion, it's the same experience that is fundamentally being expressed. And so, you know, what I would say, you know, there's this great quote from the Buddha that has kind of animated me for a good part of my adult life as a scholar and as a believer. The Buddha once said that if you want to strike water, you don't dig 6 1-foot wells, you dig 1 6-foot well. Islam is my 6-foot well. But I'm not Muslim because I think it's better or more correct. It is not. I'm Muslim because it's the well that I choose. The metaphors and the symbols, the way in which Islam talks about the divine, it appeals to me. And so that's my well. But the entire point that the Buddha was making is that the water you're drinking from is the water everybody is drinking from. So who cares about the well? The well is the tool to get to the water. I think the problem is that for many people, their faith is in their religion, not in the thing that their religion points them to, right? It's that thing where you mistake the road for the destination, you know? You mistake the metaphor for the thing that the metaphor represents. If your faith is in your religion, you're probably doing it wrong.
All right. We have time for one more. Here, I'll just go right here.
Oh, jeez. You didn't know you were going
to
be last.
I pressure of signing up to be the last one. This might be a royal letdown, and I don't want to end on like a non-scholarly note.
How about this? If your question is terrible, we'll just go
just
with somebody
else.
Just
kick me out. Honestly, I'll pack my bag before I even start. No, I just have to ask you while you're here, because my husband and I watched your TED Talk with your wife on the way up here, and it was so, I think we'd both agree, it was so endearing and hopeful for the two of us, as we're kind of on the horizon of starting an inner belief family of our own. And so I'm so curious, because I can't think of a cooler way to raise a child than to present them with, or I should say reintroduce them to the paradigm that, you know, we are not these lowly humans trying to connect with a God, but rather we are God. We are the essence of that, as you stated. And so I'm just curious how you and your wife present that to your kids, how you present your own wells to your children. It, like, is this mom's well and this is dad's well, or what's the best way of, you know, letting kids, or do they just figure it out on their own? Do we even need to present them with the wells? I don't know. It's just kind of a daunting thing going into parenthood.
Honestly, cannot think of a better question to end this on. Thank you. That's really great. My wife and I have a multi-faith family. I'm Muslim. My wife is Christian. Her family is very devout evangelicals. Her brother is an evangelical pastor. When we met, what we recognized from the start was that we saw the world in exactly the same way, that we shared the exact same values. It's just that we use different metaphors to express those values. We spoke different language. It just so happened that I was fluent in her language, and it took her a little while to become fluent in mine. You know, it's funny, if you're sitting in a restaurant and you look over and you see a couple and the guy is, you know, speaking in French and the girl is responding in German, you just think to yourself, oh, I get it. She understands French and he understands German. Well, that's what it is. When you think about religion as language, basically, that's what it does. And so for us, I think what became incredibly important when we first came together and got married was to go beyond the language and to focus on the values. Right? The values are what matters, and those values were very much the same. And then we had children. And then the question was, okay, now what do we do? And we really, you know, it was the philosophy that I just described by the Buddha. You know, we, in the same way that we want our children to be multilingual, right? We want them to learn Spanish because we live in California. You know, we want them to learn French because it'll make them cool and sexy. You know, it'll help them date. We want them to learn Mandarin so that they have a hope of a job one day. In the same way that we want them to be literally multilingual, we want them to be spiritually multilingual. And so we've made it our goal to teach them about the religions of the world. There's a lot of ways in which we do this. One thing that we do, although I have to be perfectly honest and say that we've kind of screwed up in the last few months because things have gone a little bit crazy. My wife is pregnant again. So And so we have something that we call home church, where on Sundays, you know, we get together, yeah, like 15, 20 minutes. My wife and I take turns. We'll do some teaching, you know, we'll tell the story of the Buddha, of Siddhartha Gautama, and then we'll link every one of these teachings to one particular value. So we'll talk about the Buddha, and we'll talk about compassion. And then we will do some activity that involves compassion. In this case, it was pick one of your toys that you love, because we're giving it away. it's not always successful, but you know. We have done a little bit more crazy things like that. Last summer, we went on an 80-day journey around the world with three kids. Yes, thank you. 2 7-year-olds and a 4-year-old. Yeah, you should be impressed. Yeah, you should be impressed. Did I say around the world? It's like 17 countries with three children. And everywhere we went, we immersed ourselves in a belief or a tradition or a religion or a ritual. What we don't need to teach them is that they have a soul. What we don't need to teach them is that there's a God. They were born with those two beliefs, as I just described. And in the same way that they say, you know, you teach a kid a foreign language before they're a certain age and it'll just be natural to them, it is the most natural thing in the world for them to know that there are multiple paths to this destination, that there are multiple wells, and that the water is what's important. They sit in a Sufi zikr, or they'll go to an Easter service, or they'll go to a Shabbat service, and they don't think to themselves, oh, these things are different. They think, oh yeah, okay, there's just three different ways of talking about the exact same thing. And the hope is that eventually they'll pick their own wells. I mean, that's kind of started now, but it's hard to know how serious it is, you know, because they are really still young. But one of my boys, a little more than two years ago, after a particularly raucous Rosh Hashanah service, declared himself to be Jewish. Just was like, that's it, I'm a Jew. Is this Jew? I'm a Jew. I'm whatever this is. And you know, we laughed about it, and we're like, okay, great. So that's fine, you're a Jew. And he has taken it seriously. It's been 2 years, and he is still very serious about it. You know, like a good Jew, has very good ideas about how to improve Judaism. You know, like he's got notes. He's like, you know, I've only been a Jew for 2 years, but here's what I think should be different, which is so Jewish. My other kid would say, although he's probably a little less serious about it, would call himself a Hindu. About 2 years ago, we spent a couple of months reading a pretty sophisticated but nevertheless child's version of the Ramayana. And at the end of that, he was like, yeah, this is for me. This is the religion for me. Granted, the Ramayana is about a blue god with a magic bow and arrow who fights demons. So, like, yeah, obviously. Like, any 7-year-old is going to read that and say, wait, that's a religion? This one's for me. And then we have a 4-year-old who I just imagine is like, you know, the reincarnation of the Buddha. He's still got a way to go before he decides. But I think for me, what I want to... I truly believe that the human condition is experienced to its fullest by recognizing that there is more than just the material realm. I truly believe that the reason we have this cognitive impulse, the reason we are born with it, is because we're supposed to experience it. That whether you believe that it was put there on purpose or not, that the point of being human is to use this thing that we all have, which is the ability to think in spiritual terms. And so what's important to me, and I think my wife would agree, I'm just going to go ahead and talk for her because she's not here. What's important to me is that they live their lives in those terms. Which well they pick, I couldn't care less. I just want them to drink water. Thank you.